speaking on uncertainty, determinism, scientific method, and the wisdom of Franz Boas.
Find a place to put this.
Yeah.
Oh, this is for recording, so okay. You need it. They all need right. It for you. So let's get this here somewhere. You don't have. You can put it in your pocket if it feels uncomfortable.
I think I can live with that. Is this picking up my voice? I guess
okay.
It is.
Okay. They'll worry about that. You said it's on.
Okay. Let's see if this works as well as it did before. First of all. Okay, I have to back up one. Oh, I thought I had a message for theology. I threw that in as an afterthought. This talk is concerned with a number of issues related to science and faith. Human beings dislike uncertainty. We do everything in our power to avoid and mitigate it, and yet we must deal with it constantly. The appearance of probability in physics caused great consternation. It seemed to bring uncertainty into the very laws of nature. But scientific theories are not the laws of nature. They never were and never would be. And I will get back to the issues that are on this slide, in particular, the uncertainty in physics, but I am going to reverse the order of two topics that were in my abstract and talk about the second half first, the scientific method and the wisdom of Franz Boas. It is misleading to use physics as a template for all scientific thinking. Speaking as if physics defined what scientific method must be leads to an overemphasis on quantifying and categorizing things, on analysis rather than holistic thinking. The theology must cope with a transcendent, ineffable God and dare not limit itself to scientific models or even to exclusively rational thought. Now, terms of contrast reinforce our cultural bias toward categorizing, but we are stuck with that bias. It's an essential part of our culture, and they're helpful if we don't confuse them with reality. You're all familiar with these old chestnuts from Greek philosophy. Ontology is knowing the true nature of things, that is, things really known only to God. And epistemology is humans trying to understand how it is that they know what they do know. We should stick to the latter and avoid the former. Another contrast that we run into is the true nature of things, again, an ontological statement, deterministic and causal, or are we in the hands of fickle fate? What does God know? What does science say? From our human standpoint, whatever we have to say about this issue is epistemology. And in science, methodology. Both approaches are useful in different contexts. Let us not leap to ontological conclusions from methodological success. I will suggest that the choice between a deterministic causal description and a probabilistic one is related to these contrasts: simplicity versus complexity, and repeatability versus uniqueness. This terminology may be unfamiliar to many, but surely not all of you. Cataphatic is the usual kind of theology emphasizing reason and the qualities of God that can be named. Apophatic theology emphasizes the totality of the human experience of the divine, its ineffable nature, and the dangers of becoming too attached to desires, ideas, and feelings. Both have been around since the early days of the Church, but reached their greatest development between the time of Thomas Aquinas and the Reformation. Both are useful. I would add knowing plus unknowing to this list, but it clutters the slide. That is, this is the contrast, an analytic versus holistic, reason versus experience, and conscious versus unconscious. And apophatic theology often deals with unknowing. It's related to mystical or the contemplative tradition, and there are 20th century writers that use this, for which this latter contrast comes to the fore. Theology, and I would name Evelyn Underhill, Thomas Thurman, Thomas Merton, Thomas Keating, Gerald May, Cynthia Bourgeau, and many others. Howard Thurman. I don't know why I got Thomas in there. Sorry about that. These terms are familiar to at most a handful of you. They originated in linguistics, and they've spread to many of the human sciences. Synchronic approaches to empirical study include the usual kinds of data collection, measurement, and classification, mathematical and statistical analysis, and they are clearly all recognized as scientific. And structural linguistics is also synchronic. There is no problem recognizing it as science. Ethnography is diachronic. Descriptive field notes, the subtleties of linguistic usage, the influence of language on thought and understanding are all part of this picture. Now, so let's see some diachronic evidence. Here's some examples. I'm just going to go through these quickly. Field or clinical notes, records of oral tradition, personal histories, psychotherapy records, and other narratives. Accounts of observant participation in ceremony, literature, art, poetry, and prayer. A lot of this thinking comes from field anthropology, from ethnography, but it, as you can see, there are other fields involved, like psychotherapy, and sociologists have used similar methods. Historical records and historical studies, and other types of case studies, and dialogues. So the man who started all this, the founder of modern science of anthropology, was Franz Boas. He's perhaps the greatest of the neo-Kantian philosophers of science, but the general public has never heard of him, and neither have many scientists. Only one of his many students, Margaret Mead, achieves celebrity status. In a nutshell, the neo-Kantian view of science balances the rational skepticism of natural science with a non-rational approach to reality exemplified by the arts and humanities. The two aspects, and I would add in liturgical worship as well, the two aspects of science, according to the neo-Kantian view, are Naturwissenschaft and Geisteswissenschaft, nature science, and spirit science. Given Boas's achievements, his reputation ought to match that of Newton, Darwin, Freud, and Einstein, but he's nowhere near as well known. Along with Freud and Einstein, he received his scientific training in German universities, following the philosophy of Wilhelm Humboldt, the brother of the famous explorer and naturalist Alexander, and founder of the University of Berlin in 1809. In a book titled Invisible Genealogies, Regna Darnell has documented Boas's enormous influence in all the social sciences and on society as a whole. He is the reason the word culture means what it does today. By the 1920s, the integrity of his approach had succeeded in falsifying the social Darwinist anthropology, which viewed civilizations as having advanced from primitive cultures by cultural and biological evolution, a view which supported racist ideology. The Wikipedia article on Boaz is very good, and I recommend Regna Darnell's book as well. Incidentally, I'm going to hand out a sign-up sheet if you want a list of references, which I will send you by email. There's some places in some of the later slides where I think you might want to follow up on some of these things if they are of interest to you. Boaz was a curator at the Field Museum and several other major museums before founding the first American Department of Anthropology at Columbia. And that's why I put up these two very contrasting views of the very respectable-looking scientist in his suit, and where he is posing for figures in a U.S. National Museum exhibit entitled "Hamatsa Coming Out of a Secret Room" from 1895 or before, and it's an Kwakiutl Indian ceremony for expelling cannibals. This slide summarizes Boaz's philosophy. Its influence throughout the social sciences other than anthropology is somewhat uneven. Boaz's influence on psychology owes a great deal to the relationship between my father's mentor, Edward Sapir, a student of Boaz, and the most important linguist of the 20th century, and Harry Stack Sullivan, the founder of interpersonal psychotherapy. The Chicago School of Sociology of the 1920s was founded by several of Boaz's students. Having said that, I think I need to give some examples of synchronic and diachronic data. Here's some synchronic work by Boaz. He founded anthropology as a conflation of four separate subdisciplines, which would be physical anthropology, which is what this is, archaeology, which everyone is familiar with, ethnology, the study of culture, and linguistics. But here he's dealing with physical anthropology, and this study this study was published in the early 1900s, but his data was recently reanalyzed using more modern statistical techniques, and that's one of the references I have. His conclusions were reconfirmed, and his wise use of the limited statistical methods at his disposal was praised by the investigators. Sigmund Freud was trained in the German neo-Kantian tradition, as his first published work, Interpretation of Dreams, demonstrated. But soon after its publication, he departed from this line of research, perhaps browbeaten into a more physicalist viewpoint by his medical colleagues. This is an interesting study of laboratory biologists at the Salk Institute. These two gentlemen became lab assistants in some work being done on, I think it was some early work on genomics at Salk, and they studied the process by which the scientists came to conclusions about what they were looking at under the microscope and in what the results of various laboratory studies were, and they recorded a lot of their informal discussions as well as everything else. They actually participated in the research as lab assistants. In spite of their lack of background in biology, they were able to do some participation and take some of the scut work off of the hands of the biologists. One of the things they found was that facts are constructed through an ongoing dialogue among the scientists. And they said, yes, of course that happens. We just take it for granted. They didn't think it was important. They didn't see it as something discovered by scientific investigation. It's just sort of, oh, yes. And there was a certain amount of denial, though, however, that facts were constructed. Here's a study that included both synchronic and diachronic approaches, because he used structural linguistics to study the Hopi language, but he also participated and involved himself in their culture over a period of 2 or 3 years and began to understand how the language was used and how it expressed their worldview. And he talks about that in one of the references that I would be able to send out to you. The diachronic study, really, many of the writings on Christian contemplative prayer are a form of diachronic study. Some of them are in the form of poetry, some are narrative, some are commentary on poetry. There's a great deal of, it's a very large literature. It goes back to the time of Constantine. And as I mentioned, some of the early modern writers in earlier on, and I'll again have some of those references in the it was going to be a handout, but I was not able to get it printed up in time. And I have to take my slam at the dismal science. It imitates physics to an excessive degree, and very little of its theory is based on actual observation of economic behavior. At its worst, the economy is viewed as a mechanical system that can be modeled by laws aping Newton's laws of motion. The invisible hand of the free market is treated as an axiom, with the pre-19th century meaning of axiom as self-evident truth, not the modern mathematical meaning of axiom as simply a starting assumption. The latest recrudescence of this kind of dismal science is the so-called neoclassical economics. There are, of course, exceptional economists who do not follow the herd and recognize that economics needs to become a legitimate human science. Okay, it's now later. We'll go back to that first slide, and I'll start talking about that. Ontological determinism increased its influence in the 18th and 19th century and well into the 20th. They really did believe they had discovered the laws of nature. The media popularized version of this still dominates thinking about science. Even Darwin's natural selection was initially viewed through the distorted lens of ontological determinism and treated as a law of nature. It was not until after Mendel's results were assimilated by research biologists and physicians that descent with modification began to be thought of as some kind of a random process. Even among scientists, there was a general view that all the laws of nature had been discovered, as we shall see in the next slide. The general public began to be captivated by science and science-based technology and became increasingly modernist in their thought. Scientistic materialism and a belief in the unlimited progress leading to a man-made utopia captured the modern mind. Now, these are the two quotes that I think are really priceless. Of course, Michelson in particular obviously believed that physical science had discovered the laws of nature. I think Maxwell, who was, of course, an evangelical Christian, is a little more restrained about it. He doesn't make any ontological statements. Okay, the demise of this idea. Uncertainty first entered science in statistical physics. And ironically, Maxwell contributed to this uncertainty in his kinetic theory of ideal gases. Digging deeper into the subject, Boltzmann was so harassed by his colleagues for promoting the statistical view of physics as well as atomic theory that he committed suicide. Special relativity challenged notions of absolute space, absolute time, and the assumption that all observers will observe the same thing. General relativity went still further. Whoops, I went too fast there to back up. Come on, back up. Oh, here we are. No, I went too far back. Here we are. All right. So anyway, the relativity challenged the notion that man-made theories are the laws of nature. The challenge from quantum physics is far greater. Some philosophers of science seem to have missed this point altogether. The ontological truth of a scientific theory is no longer a tenable belief. The picture of physical reality painted by quantum theory is very different from that of classical physics, which includes all prior physical theory, including general and special relativity. This slide is designed to give you some idea of the difference. And I'm just going to click through these bullets and just read them. Quantum theory appears to place probability and thus apparently randomness in the very heart of science. However, quantum theory is deterministic in the unobservable infinite dimensional space of quantum states or systems. It involves a set of dynamic equations, very much like Newton's equations, except the thing that's changing is in an infinite, it's in Hilbert space is the name of the space. Every quantum system is coupled non-linearly and non-locally to all other quantum systems, and in particular to its environment and any measurement apparatus. This idea is expressed most strongly in a relatively recent point of view. It began in 1970 or thereabouts, called decoherence, and I don't want to say too much about that because of time. Information is transferred between systems and is lost when measurements are made. The observed measurements must sometimes be described probabilistically. And if the coupling with the environment is chaotic, because it's nonlinear, it may be chaotic, there is an additional source of uncertainty in the specifying of initial conditions. Now, there's so much misperception of quantum physics and so many foolish things have been said about it. So, in particular, the apparently fundamental nature of randomness has led most physicists to avoid investigations of its foundations, more of this abhorrence of uncertainty. We don't really know what's going on here. Let's just talk about the observables, the things we can observe, and let's not get too involved with this quantum state, because it's pretty mysterious. We seem to need it for mathematical reasons in our theory, but we have some techniques that work, and particularly in particle physics, and they've been labeled by one physicist as "shut up and calculate." In other words, if you're a graduate student and you're wondering about what's really going on in quantum mechanics, don't think about it. Just follow these rules that Feynman gave you and use your Feynman diagrams and make your calculations and forget about the foundations of quantum physics. So it's led, this confusion even among physicists had led some philosophers and non-physicist scientists to assume that the chance is ontological because it's been embedded in quantum physics. And the public is totally confused and mystified. Their eyes just glaze over when you talk about quantum physics. I can't resist this quote by one of the greatest scientists of all times. "The eyes of the scientist are directed upon those phenomena which are accessible to observation. In the attempt to achieve a conceptual formulation of the confusingly immense body of observational data, the scientist makes use of a whole arsenal of concepts which he imbibed practically with his mother's milk. And seldom, if ever, is he aware of the eternally problematic character of his concepts. He uses these conceptual tools of thought as something obviously immutably given, something having an objective value of truth which is hardly ever to be doubted. How could he do otherwise? And yet, in the interests of science, it is necessary to engage in the critique of these fundamental concepts in order that we may not be ruled by them. This becomes evident when the consistent use of the traditional fundamental concepts leads to paradoxes difficult to resolve, or as St. Paul put it, doubtful disputations. The reproducibility of results is the hallmark of empirical natural science, complexity limits reproducibility. And as you move up the scale of complexity from physics to chemistry to biology to human behavior, the ability to reproduce an experimental or observational study declines. The scientific view of reality is incomplete. It sheds light on the nature of reality as experienced by our outward senses, but not on the essence of reality as it is experienced. Nevertheless, it can enhance our appreciation as well as our understanding of the nature of the spiritual. The message for theology and philosophy in general, and philosophy of science in particular, is that all human knowledge is uncertain, not only quantitatively, but conceptually. Reason must always yield to the data of experience, whether expressed quantitatively or qualitatively, whether objective or intersubjective. Beyond natural science, statistical and other quantitative methods and generalized theory can only supplement diachronic approaches and must not dominate the human sciences, including a scientific theology of the future. And what is needed to really understand, to have a good scientific theology, is not just to understand the spiritual world in the context of our own Christian tradition, but to engage in interfaith and cross-cultural studies and dialogue on human spirituality. And I think it's essential for sound theology and also for global mutual understanding. So finally, we need to accept the limits of human knowing and the reality of mystery. Ontological claims should be banned from science and rational philosophy, and maybe from theology as well, although we have to say things like, we know that Jesus rose from the dead. Apophatic theology is undervalued, and cataphatic theology is overvalued. Okay, anybody have some questions? Is there any time for questions?
If you would like to stay and talk to either of our speakers, I think they would be willing to stay and then talk. But we do still have a few minutes before our 4:30. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, 5.
So your argument then, by referring to Boaz.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. That kind of approach is really needed in the human sciences. Human sciences that rely almost exclusively on statistics and very general sorts of data are missing a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that school did not persist. There was a change of the guard sometime in the 1930s. And so a lot of his influence, the reason that the book about him is called Invisible Genealogies, is that the thread kind of got broken in spite of the fact that, except in departments of anthropology and linguistics, unfortunately, are mostly secular, and sometimes Christians have trouble in dealing with these departments, and particularly, I know there are some missionaries. The missionary Jacob Lowen was not permitted, for example, to enroll in the anthropology department at the University of Washington. I believe this was in the 1960s. But he was able to enroll in the linguistics department. They knew he was going to involved with the Wycliffe Bible Institute, and he went off to South America, and he's written some very interesting things that have to find them on. They've been published. They're sort of on-demand publishing books right now. Hard to find. Barnes & Noble has them. Amazon.com doesn't. The sociology department that I referred to did use Boaz's methods, but they did go beyond them, and they said, for example, that relying on a single informant from a culture is not enough. You really need to have at least more patience than that, or more, or in their case, they could go to a city and go to some neighborhood and study the local culture of some immigrant group, for example, or some other special group within the society, that having more than one informant was very important, that otherwise you could get a real bias. In some cases, a lot of early anthropology was trying to salvage what was left of a culture, and often one or two people was all they could get. Yes, it's true that you can get a biased picture that way, but you also get a longitudinal view. You get a whole picture. And of course, in medicine, you're dealing with individual patients, and a lot of the statistical studies, I mean, and I've done a lot of, most of my career was in statistics. They're very good and they're necessary, but what about the exceptional patient, the one that doesn't, you know, or that isn't the typical, or the average, or whatever? The most patients are better off with this medication than that one, but there's some knowledge you have that beyond the study. You don't go with just one study or just one group of studies that show, unless it's, if there's some indication that this medication might help this patient, even though in general it's been shown to be ineffective or something like that, you may be justified in going ahead. I can see how there may be a way to do that in medicine. How you develop a diachronic medical practice is something that physicians will have to work out, and it hasn't been done. But they might look to some of this literature and see what some of what Edward Sapir wrote. Again, I mentioned him as my father's mentor. Part of this was a matter of, I tried to write a book a few years ago, and I got a big manuscript, but among other things, I ended up learning about my father's field in a way I never had before, and it was quite revealing.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you again.
Well, if anyone wants to ask for these references, I got a sign-up sheet here. You want me to?
Mm-hmm. Where did you teach?
I didn't teach for very long. I spent most of my career in the Boeing Company in an applied mathematics unit, and doing consulting and mostly statistics and probability, but some other things as well. A little bit of this.